Hey there. We at Blue Wire wanted to thank you for your continued support of this podcast. With over 90 podcasts across our network, we are committed to bringing you great content to fill that sports-shaped hole in your heart. To find more Blue Wire pods, search for us on iTunes or check out BlueWirePods.com. And remember, one day sports will return and it will be glorious. Thanks for listening. On to the show.
Blue Wire.
Breaking news, Terry Rozier. He'll be the next starting point guard of the Charlotte Hornets.
Step back, wide open, and it's good! Terry Rozier!
Lynn has the fire! Oh! Oh! Right there! Oh! Some frequent flyer miles!
All right, welcome in to another Buzz Beat, your favorite Charlotte Hornets podcast. This episode is brought to you by our partners, betonline.ag. On today's podcast, we're going to get into more college prospect discussion, but we're going to focus on players that may drop to the second round. We're kind of focusing on those players that could be there. They may go before, but definitely players that will not be someone we're going to be considering with the eighth overall pick. Brian Spencer, how is everything going with you guys?
Going good. I'm just at the point where, like, I get on these Zoom calls and or work calls on the phone, and people are like, "So, how's it going?" I'm like, every time, I'm just like, "Yeah, good. Just adjusting to the new reality." I feel like I've said that like 50 times in a row now. I don't know what else to say.
It is amazing how quickly, like, you can fall into these new habits. You know what I mean? It's like good and bad, the human condition in that regard, I suppose. The thing that I'm starting to get annoyed at a little bit is the need to say at the top of, you know, every article I write or every article I read, the need to either mention it myself or see mentioned, like, assuming sports comes back, here's what's going to happen. Or the feeling, the need to preface everything with, okay, but, you know, we realize this sports-related thing isn't that important. And it's true. I just wish there was already that understanding, so everything didn't have to be prefaced with this layer of, we understand that things are bad, right? You know what I mean? Right. And it's like, everyone is aware of this at all times. So I don't know. I find myself, like, becoming annoyed that I need to, like, constantly state the obvious. But I suppose of all the things in the world, it's not the worst, but it's just like a little annoying, I feel like.
I do want to, you know, what we podcast about in our sports driven world, I do want to give a shout out to the NBA, or excuse me, the NFL. I thought they did a nice job with the draft.
Yeah,
it certainly had some hiccups quite sure about some of the strategy on the content, but look, overall, like, Trey Wingo and that team did a great job, and yeah. I cannot overemphasize how excited I was at noon on Saturday to realize, like, I can cut on something that's, like, sports related and it's live. Like, yeah. Right now, I mean, the first round was nice. Yeah, Friday night, second round, third round, that was great. But Saturday at noon, realizing there were sports on TV or something of the semblance was pretty awesome.
It was nice. Yeah. I didn't watch much beyond the first round. It was sort of like, I mean, I was keeping up with it, but didn't, now that you mentioned that, man, it sounds kind of nice to just be, like, on the couch watching that on Saturday. I'm kind of mad I missed out on that, actually.
And that's the funny thing. Like, I actually just threw on YouTube TV doing some stuff outside. It was just the idea that there was something sports related live on at noon on a week, you know, on a weekend day. It was just like, it just felt normal. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, NBA kind of learning from the NFL and how they did their draft. I think NFL has it harder because they have seven rounds, so you got more opportunity for mess ups and things of that nature. But I thought overall they did a good job. And like you, Brian, I only watched fully intently the first round. The other rounds were just kind of on in the background. So let's go ahead and jump into this with these prospects that are probably late first round, early second round. And actually, Spencer, we're going to lead off with the one that you chose to start this episode with Precious Achiuwa. I believe you guys have talked about him before, but let's go ahead and talk about him again. Freshman out of Memphis. So go ahead, Spencer.
Yeah, Precious Achiuwa. He's a 6'9", a little over 220. I guess you call him a power forward. I mean, I think this guy's going to be able to play a lot of different positions. You know, he's 20 years old. He'll be closing in on 21. at draft age. Of course, again, can't emphasize enough, we don't know when that draft is going to be, but I first dove in on this guy, like really digging deep, scouting him a few weeks back. It was probably about 3 weeks ago. And I saw him play some this season. You know, James Wiseman obviously didn't play very much in Memphis this year. So Precious became, you know, the number one scouted player on that Memphis team pretty quickly when James, you know, went through his troubles. And the one game I really watched is the Tennessee game. But other than that, I really hadn't seen enough about him. I just knew he was a highly regarded prospect and a very highly regarded high school player. You know, the first thing that I would say about Precious is that he has the ability defensively to be that do-it-all type of switch off every position, jump passing lanes, blow up ball screens, block shots at the rim, just cover sideline to sideline in half court to the baseline. I mean, he has that kind of defensive coverage potential. He doesn't always choose to show that with his motor and his effort, but this guy's ceiling defensively, we can debate other prospects in this draft pool. You can't convince me anybody's is higher than his. You really can't. I mean, he can just cover so much ground. And so that's what I would start with. But the reality of Precious is that he is a low IQ basketball player right now. And he played on the wing in high school. He had the ball in his hands a lot. You know, you saw these moments, especially after Wiseman, you know, went out of the lineup, where Precious has got the ball on the wing. You know, he takes one or two dribbles into the paint and he'll drive it into three bodies. Yes. He doesn't care, you know, and he rarely gets his teammates involved. But when he does get that one or two dribbles free to the rim, he's an explosive athlete that can finish. And just type into YouTube Precious Achiuwa transition. I mean, this guy is an absolute monster in transition. The idea of him, the pie in the sky idea, I always get trapped by one of these guys every year, and he's going to be the one this year, is high, high, high ceiling. I mean, his athleticism and body type kind of reminds me a little bit of Pascal Siakam. He's obviously not anywhere close to as polished as Siakam was coming out of college, and he will never be that polished of a player. But I do see him as a small ball five potentially in the league that could come in and wreak havoc just with his energy. And if he puts it together offensively with the shot, and I'm sure you guys will have some numbers here in a little bit. I mean, he didn't shoot it great last year, showed a little bit of promise there. But if he can be a threat from the corners and buy into the idea of being a small ball rim runner, I think he can really be a super impactful player in the NBA.
Yeah, I think that's where he does thrive, is on rim running. And I kind of project him out to be a center, like you said, a small ball center more so than a four. Very good in the pick and roll. Basically, you get him running towards the rim and you just put him in pick and roll situations. The less he has to think, the better he does. So you put the ball in his hands a little bit more often, and he has to think through things. Like Spencer was saying, he'll drive in traffic when there's three guys on him. Defensively, right away on the NBA level, I feel like his versatility, his wingspan, 7'2 wingspan, is going to be able to bother guards out on the perimeter, and he can stay with guards. Like, we've seen that from him. His footwork is pretty good on that, and then either wings or bigs that are going to take it to him into the body, he still has that wingspan to block him. So yeah, offensively, he's very, very, I guess, unskilled or very raw. I think teams that are going to be drafting this guy are banking on the fact that he will develop a shot. He will develop that handle a little bit more and his finishing around the rim. So right now, all you can kind of point to is him thriving in transition and thriving as a pick and roll threat. I will say that he does time the offensive rebounds pretty well. He's not afraid to get physical down low. It's just he lacks body control. Like, especially when you put other opponents around him, he doesn't know how to tone it down. We talk about this a lot with a shot. You know, the free throw shooting sometimes translates over to maybe something from behind the arc. And he only shot the ball from the free throw line at 59.9%. So that is one area of concern that, you know, it doesn't directly translate. But if you're hoping that he develops a shot, that free throw percentage is not something that I'd be looking at right now.
His handle's interesting because I feel like that if you're going to get to his ceiling as a player, you need to fix the footwork on his jump shot and, you know, obviously turn him into a better spot up threat. I mean, he's pretty good on a straight line now, but the handle's wild. There's certainly grab and go potential. and he shot the ball pretty well in transition, pretty healthy. I mean, I think over 60% in transition this year. So there's some interesting potential with him as like an end-to-end guy and someone who can attack space off the dribble or go at players. Right now it's not there, but it doesn't mean he couldn't develop. He is, I feel like, and Spencer was sort of getting at this with some of the defensive talk with Precious, is like with him, though, you really do need to start with his versatility defensively. He's the most obvious sort of like 1 through 5 defender in the draft this year. And he played a lot of 5 at Memphis once Wiseman was ineligible. And that forced him into a more challenging role offensively, which probably didn't help his overall advanced numbers on offense, right? Which aren't too good, right? Like he does not have great advanced numbers in aspects of his offensive game, in part because the shot wasn't great either. I rewatched the NC State Memphis game from Thanksgiving again recently, and he did pretty well switching on that game. Some nice possessions on CJ Bryce and Markel Johnson, and those guys, like Markel and CJ are really good ACC guards. And Markel got him once with a little bit of a shoulder fake, and Precious was a little jumpy on it. But other than that, he did pretty well. He's a nice team defender. I think that is one of those things you have to mention with him, is because yes, he has the ability to switch out and guard a bunch of positions, but you know, tag a roller, get back out, close out on a shooter. Like he checks those boxes, which he covers
a lot of space.
Yeah, exactly. So that gives him like kind of a nice floor defensively, and then all of a sudden, if you can really unlock some of the switch potential where he can move out and guard 4 or 5 positions, you know, now you're really talking about something, especially if you can turn something on offensively too. You know, he's a development piece, obviously. It's going to take time. It may take a year. It may take a couple years. Yeah, I do think the Hornets are in a vacuum. The Hornets are in an okay position to absorb a player like that into the roster, right? Like, they've invested a lot of resources in player development the last year or so, and they're not going to be good next season. You know, like they have resources and time on their hands. And so, yeah, like in theory, I think Precious, he could fit into that structure, but yeah, it's just going to take some time to unlock, yeah, or no maybe doubt. even like break ground, making this guy like, you know, any kind of a functional offensive piece. But defensively, yeah, he's an interesting player for sure.
You know, I think that for what it's worth, I think that 8 is too high for him. I mean, the last ESPN mock draft, that's where we, you know, we saw him follow the Hornets, and a lot of people were like, excuse me, I don't even know who this guy is.
Yeah.
And so I think that was a fair reaction. We've seen him on some mock drafts, tankathons. He's at 32. So, mm-hmm. You know, it's pretty easy to see. And if you've listened to all 3 of us describe him now, it's pretty easy to see why he's such a volatile prospect.
Yeah.
I mean, the idea of him is grand. And, you know, you imagine him being defensively, if it all comes together, almost like a Draymond Green type of player, except he's 6'9", right?
Right.
And then his ability to grab it off the glass and put it on the floor and make plays in transition, that is what gets me over everything else.
25% defensive rebound rate, too. It's just a monster number.
You know, it's just when he goes up and he snatches the rebound and he immediately puts it on the floor – you know, this guy he's leading the break at 6'9". And his quickness and his straight line speed, it kind of like we talked about with Kyra Lewis, it's in different ways, track athlete kind of speed. But if you watch his acceleration, like when he doesn't have the ball in transition, you'll see him read the guy who might be on the wing with the ball, the guy at half court. If he sees a lane to sprint, he can change speeds so quickly for an athlete of that size. And I see that kind of stuff. And that's where I'm like, man, if you just make him play in the half court in a gym for 6 months and don't let him leave. All this stuff in transition, that's natural ability. That's not going anywhere. He can do that in his sleep. Make him play in the half court nonstop. Make him, you know, do your best to develop his feel for the game, and then let him use all his shot blocking, his speed, his quick feet. let all that melt into the feel of the game. I just think he's a little bit of a sleeper. I know we've seen him as high as eight, but I really don't mind this guy going in the lottery, late lottery. I think he's got that much upside.
She shot 65% on basket rolls this season, which is a pretty good number. Not a huge sample, but there, as you guys said earlier, there is some pick and roll, maybe even some pick and pop potential. Again, that's assuming he gets down the handle and the ability to shoot off the catch and a little bit of movement. I mean, that may be way further down the road, but it exists, I think. Most of his shots around the basket this season, shot 64% at the rim. About 62% of those looks were assisted on, so that's kind of a lot. The looks, though, I think he had a questionable shot selection. And it's one of those things. It's like if any of these guys play enough minutes and you watch them play enough, you're going to see these guys take some tough shots. But he took, I mean, some brutal mid-range and long twos this season.
Just like no clue.
Yeah. And on close to 100 attempts, he shot 21% in the mid-range this season, which is, again, a brutal number for what was a pretty high usage player, usage rate north of 27%, which is steep. So can't really pass yet, can't make a free throw. Jumper is sort of broken. Like with this guy, you'd have to be so incredibly patient in terms of monitoring and helping aid his development.
Hey, let's take a break real quick and then we'll get back and finish up on Achiuwa. With currently no NBA, NHL, or MLB, you might think there's nothing to bet on. Well, you'd be wrong. Our exclusive partner, BetOnline, still has hundreds of events, games, and props to wager on. From their online casino to poker to blackjack, they're bringing Vegas to you.
Missing the NFL? No problem. BetOnline has live daily Madden NFL 20 simulations that you can bet on. You can still bet on Survivor, Big Brother, American Idol, stock prices, and even the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest.
All open 24 hours a day and online. Use promo code BLUEWIRE to join today and receive your new welcome bonus. BetOnline, your online wagering solution.
Guys, looking to last longer and go a few extra rounds? Go to BlueChew.com. BlueChew.com has the first ever chewable that brings your performance in the bedroom to another level.
They've got the same active ingredients that are in Viagra and Cialis, so you know they work. And since they're chewable, they work faster. You can take them anytime, day or night, even on a full stomach. Plus, you don't even need to go to the doctor's office or spend time waiting in the pharmacy line.
Blue Chew's online physician is free of cost, and once approved, your order ships straight to your door in discreet packaging. Here's a great deal for you guys. Visit BlueChew.com and get your first order free when you use promo code BLUEWIRE. Just pay $5 shipping. Again, that's BlueChew.com, promo code BLUEWIRE.
All right, let's head back to Precious and wrap him up. I do have a question for you guys in terms of maybe not just Precious, but just any prospect in general, because this guy is clearly raw, a raw talent, and that's why there's so much variance in where he could go in the NBA draft. I think developing a shot could be something that the teams are going to want to focus on, but how hard do you think it is to develop IQ? Like he, because a lot of times when you watch him play, it's almost like he doesn't realize that he's surrounded by multiple defenders and he's got an open guy in the corner. To me, I feel like developing his actual skills could be easier than maybe developing his feel for the game. So have you ever thought about that in terms of like how you develop the IQ?
Yeah. The time. I mean, we talked about this with Nasir Little last year, right? Yeah. About a year ago. And you want to be, I know what you guys mean, but we even said this when we talked about Nasir Little last year. This isn't like an IQ thing, right? This is like a feel thing. This is a basketball skill thing. Like, listen to Precious talk. He's a smart young dude, but like, I think it's just, you just got to play basketball. You have to play a lot of basketball. There's got to be other ways for you to learn, you know, that playing pickup, watching film. We even talked about this with Nasir Little again last year too, but like, is there any sort of like AI simulation that you can put on and just go through pick and roll reps or, you know, short roll reps over and over again. Like there should be no outer limits to what these guys can do as far as like watching tape and getting reps and trying to apply it. But I think that's the main thing is it's hard work. It's playing games, it's playing pickup, and it's watching a lot of film. And I think all of that skill stuff starts with the fundamentals, and then you build out from there, though.
Yeah. I mean, I agree with most of that. I think that it's mentality, right? Like it goes back to the Patrick Williams conversation we were having last week. I mean, if the kid's got it and wants to get better, he's going to get better, period. It's going to happen. I mean, that's what it usually comes down to. I think with Precious, I think a few things are interesting. I think he played on the wing in high school. He came from a high school. He was able and allowed to do whatever he wanted in high school. So he had the ball in his hands a lot. It probably didn't look a whole lot prettier in high school. He was just going against inferior athletes, right? And people recognized his athleticism. So they're like, this is a really highly regarded high school player. You get him in college where, number one, he's playing against better competition, more athletic competition, more physical competition, and they change his position and ask him to play center, a position he's really never played his entire career. And it's like having to learn to ride the bike again. I mean, this kid had no freaking clue how to play center. And so, I look at some of his numbers and I say, okay. I'm willing to give this a little bit of a pass because I think he's still learning there. To me, the downside of Precious is a rotational energy spark plug, right? It comes in, guards a bunch of different positions, runs hard in transition, just puts pressure on both sides of the floor. But the upside is if he does create a real feel for the game, you know, learns how to kill his dribble when he needs to, get onto the next play, keep moving, keep screening, keep diving. If he learns how to do those things, he's going to be potentially a starting power forward, you know, that can score, I think, 12 to 15 points a night. I mean, I think the ceiling's that high. So for me, it's the same thing as the Patrick Williams thing. It's like, what is his mentality? Does he want to really sharpen the knife and get better as a player?
The difference between him and Patrick Williams to me is Patrick Williams has shown a little bit of a shot. He didn't shoot the ball too well from behind the arc, but just his mid-range shot, we talked about this last week. I'm not comparing him to this guy at all, but I just kind of get these like vibes of, again, not totally one-to-one here, but like something like a Bismack Biyombo, where you see all this rawness of a player and you just got to develop a lot of skill. And I like this guy as an athlete. I like this guy in terms on the defensive side, being able to switch out on guards and stuff like that. And his block rate is really high, but there's just something about him that I'm just a little bit hesitant on. And let's just say we trade back. I'm going to pose this question. Let's say we trade back to number 20. And I think, Spencer, I know this answer for you, but let's say we're at 20 and he's available. Do you draft him?
I lean towards no. I'm more open to the possibility. I haven't done quite a big board yet. I'm not sure if I would have Precious in my top 20 prospects. But, yeah, I mean, I think I could find a player that I was more comfortable selecting. And this is maybe a bit of a cop-out answer, but I'm certainly more open to the possibility of taking him at 20 as opposed to inside the top 10 or inside the lottery, especially, you know, assuming if you're moving back, you're picking up other assets and draft capital too. So, yes, that would make me, that would open the possibility, but I still think I could find more value actually with the number 20, with another possibility at the number 20 pick over Precious.
Yeah. And I wouldn't disagree with what Brian just said. I mean, there's probably still a lot of good value, better value out there at 20. What does it for me is it's the Bismack Biyombo comparison came up, Richie. And you know, I think from a true rawness perspective, that's very fair. You know, this kid's feet and his hips and his flexibility and his athleticism. It's thinking about a guy like Biz, it's miles, miles beyond him. So I just think that there's less to chip away here to have a real finished product. He's kind of hiding in the grass to me. There's so much potential with this kid. So obviously I would take him at 20.
All right, let's transition to the prospect that I'm going to present. Someone who is probably have a, I would say a higher floor, all things go right, but his ceiling is definitely not at the ceiling of Precious. So I'm going to go with Killian Tilly, senior out of Gonzaga, 6'10", 220 pounds, and he's also 22 years old. I think the biggest thing that we need to kind of put out there is his injury history. Freshman year, he had a broken finger. His sophomore year, he had a hip injury in the NCAA tournament. His junior year, he had an ankle stress fracture. He missed the first 8 weeks of the season. He actually declared for the NBA draft after his junior year, but during the NBA combine, he missed it because of injury. So then he returned for his senior season, and he missed the first four games of that season to, quote-unquote, clean up his knee. So the injury history here is clearly visible, and if you are drafting him, I think his role on any NBA team is going to probably come down to his health. If he can stay healthy, everything that we're going to talk about today is clearly going to be present. But if he can't stay healthy, it's just probably going to be more of the same with Killian Tilly. So I'm going to kind of start with his positives here. I think he's a big that can shoot the ball. He's a stretchy big, a factor in the pick and pop game. He doesn't necessarily like get off the floor as an athlete, but you know, he still has some mobility. I'm sure the injury status probably affects that a little bit. I almost view him in a way, if he can stay healthy, as a little bit less athletic Cody Zeller, who can shoot the ball. I see him as a ball mover. I see him as a screen setter. He does have handles. He has pretty solid handles for a big. He can maneuver in traffic, unlike Precious, who doesn't really realize the players that are around him. So Killian Tilly, I'm intrigued by him. I think I would be open to drafting him in the second overall pick in the second round. But the biggest thing that it's going to come down to is, one, his injury history, but then on the defensive side of the ball, this is something that he is totally unlike Precious. Can he defend in space, or is he just going to be one of those drop defenders that we normally see? I like Killian Tilly a lot, but I think the injury kind of scares me off a bit.
I like Killian Tilly a great deal. The injuries are obviously scary, and they're the only reason this guy isn't in the NBA right now. And because he really does have like the skill set that is good enough to project as a lottery pick, right? But just because of the injuries, he missed close to 40 games during his career at Gonzaga. Wow. With a variety of injuries. I think I counted it up last night. It was 38 games he missed while at Gonzaga of the possible games he could have played in. He turned 22 in March, born actually one day after Obi Toppin, which is kind of funny. But he is just a monster shooter from the stretch, you know, stretch five position. 44% career shooting on threes, almost 240 attempts, 60% shooting on twos, 75% shooting from the free throw line. Doesn't get to the line a ton, but still 75% shooting from the line on close to 200 career attempts, 62% effective shooting, 64% career true shooting percentage. This season, he shot 72% at the rim, 50% on long twos. And in the 2017-2018 season, which is like, I mean, he was really good this year, but his sophomore year may have been his best year. But 1.25 points per possession on spot ups that year, 72% effective shooting, just a monster number for a 6'10 guy that can move. And again, like he has some movement shooting skills, you know, roll replace actions, his ability to pop, slip into space. He was an elite pick and pop player in college for his career. 1.26 points per possession on pick and pops this season, 64% effective shooting on pick and pop jumpers. That was top 10 in Division I in pick and pop efficiency. And during his sophomore season in 17-18, 52% shooting on pick and pop, 69% effective shooting too. Like, he's got short roll skills, decent passer, not like an amazing passer, but he's got some craft. He can put the ball on the deck in the open court. Mm-hmm. He can attack a closeout, which he's going to force closeouts with his shot. I mean, he's a very good 3-point shooter, has great range, shoots an easy ball, even has like a little crossover he can get to, which like looks crazy because he's mobile, but not like a super, you know, fluid athlete or anything like that. But I think there's serious DHO potential. This guy's ability to help with his ability to stretch the defense, run pick and pop. He can get the ball from side A to side B and back as a facilitator, and just a guy that can help you change the shot sides of the floor while also stretching out the defense. I think that's a really, really, really good athlete. Grew up volleyball player. So quick off his feet, maybe not like super explosive, you know, but quick off his feet, really good touch. I mean, you can see on some of his offensive rebound tip backs, like his ability to just slap at it and just paw it right into the rim. Pretty impressive, actually. And he moved well in Gonzaga's continuity ball screen offense, like constantly screening, diving, popping, posting, like just has a lot of versatility to his offensive game. I love Killian Tilly as a prospect, and I think it would be great for the Hornets to get a young center in the pipeline. If you could use this early second round pick to get Tilly or Paul Reed, I mean, I think you're getting really good value out of that pick. And I get the injury risks with Tilly, but man, he's a really gifted offensive player, 6'10", coming out of a program that every year they just spit out more awesome front court prospects.
Yeah, I mean, Tilly's he's the best offensive big in this draft, probably, right? I mean, from a shooting standpoint, probably. You know, I mean, he's as a pick and pop player, he's an ace. Yeah. You know, 1.3 points per possession on pick and pop plays. I mean, that's it doesn't get any better than that. So I think that if you don't like Tilly as a prospect, then you probably haven't watched him play very much. You know, he comes to the table with something that you can't miss on, just shooting ability as a big man. And as Brian mentioned too, who he's going to force closeouts, and he's proven that he can beat a closeout. Pretty good feet, pretty good passing instincts, great feel for the game and IQ. I think that's pretty much a unanimous trait of his.
Yep.
So there's not much to miss on here unless the medical history really bites you. So everybody's already said that. He is older. I mean, he's going to be close to 23 years old, or at least 22 and a half, excuse me, probably when the draft happens. So that certainly isn't a plus, but at the same time, man, when you're getting a player that's going to bring you immediate value, like Killian Tilly, who I think should be able to step into the NBA year one and play backup center minutes, you know, then I think you go ahead and draft him, especially if you're talking about a second round type of pick. I wouldn't be surprised to see him making the first round, though. I mean, I don't think he will because of his age and his medical history, but you're getting enough return for investment here, I think, right away to make it worth it, you know, in that late first round stage, especially for a team that's already, you're imagining he's going to be in the playoffs, right? So, you know, the last thing I would say about Tilly is I think there's a chance. Again, he's got to stay healthy. I think there's a chance he's what Frank Kaminsky, the idea was supposed to be.
100%. I've got that in my notes. He's got the Kaminsky, like the good parts of what you saw with Kaminsky at Wisconsin in his game too. It's the pick and pop potential, the ability to stretch a defense, pass, post up mismatches, and help switch sides of the floor. That, yes, in theory, that's what you wanted with Frank too.
We just said this, but I think if you take out the injury history, he's definitely a first round pick.
Oh, easily.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that's really the biggest thing that's kind of hanging me up on him. And it's not like it's like, you know, one season where he had injuries. It was basically every season that I mentioned, he had some kind of injury. And, you know, it just happens that way with some players where they're just unlucky. You know, I mentioned Cody Zeller as well. He's been unlucky in his NBA career, not really having full season. So, but the good news is if you do draft this guy in the second round, I feel a little bit better about drafting someone like this that has an injury history. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. And I think Hornets fans are used to, you know, second round picks being traded anyways.
I think if you can get this guy, I mean, if you get Tilly late in the first round, I think that's a really good pick too. But I mean, if the Hornets lucked up and got this guy early second round, you sign him on one of those cheapo second round deals, 3 years, you get his bird rights. I mean, that's just, it's a slam dunk in my opinion. He has, like you said, Spencer, he reminds me of Kaminsky a fair amount. I think it's, you really probably shouldn't compare guys to Marc Gasol, but I think maybe it's because of the high socks and the 33 and his ability to handle a little bit and pick and pop. Either. Again, I don't want to compare him to Gasol too much, but sometimes when you watch him play, you get those. He's not, obviously, he's nowhere near as big and burly as Gasol. And Gasol's like, you know, a for the modern game, a historically good defensive center. So I'm not trying to like draw a line between those two. Just some, he reminds me at times of Kaminsky. He reminds me at times of Gasol in these very like specific ways. And he is a good, he's a good post up player too. Got like a nice righty hook shot, but he can drop that left shoulder. You know what I mean? Spin to the baseline, spin on that left foot. He kind of reminds you of PJ Washington a little bit. You know, PJ loves that sort of, especially when he's at Kentucky, but we saw it this year too, where PJ gets it on the right block and he's able to spin towards the baseline and get to that righty hook. Like that's Tilly's go-to move inside the arc. You know, you can counter that by spinning to the paint and shooting a fadeaway. Just 7 dunks this season and only 46 for his career, but his sophomore season, he had 22 dunks. His sophomore year also had a block rate above 4%. So yeah, maybe some of the injuries did take away some of the athletic pop, like the vertical pop that he had. But obviously he still moves well. He's still fluid, just maybe perhaps vertically not quite as explosive. And he shot 58% on post-ups this season, over 1.1 points per possession, which is obviously a healthy number on decent volume too.
Brian, before we get to your prospect, I mean, where do you guys think that this guy ranks among Killians in this draft?
He's in the top 3 at least.
Yeah,
right? He's got to be.
Yeah, I would say so too. So.
He's not the best Killian in this draft. Yeah.
He's good though. He's quite good.
All right, go ahead, Brian.
Yeah, should we go ahead and flip over to Trey Jones here? Do you guys have any last thoughts on Tilly? No? All right. Okay, here we go. Trey Jones. This is a guy I saw a lot of at Duke. I watched every game he played in. Saw him probably up close to 25, 30 times, most of the home games he played at, if not all the home games he played at while at Duke. He's listed at 6'3". I don't think Trey Jones is 6'3". Just like Cole Anthony's listed at 6'3". I've seen those guys. I stood next to those guys. I don't think they're 6'3".
You're saying they're smaller.
What?
You're saying they're smaller.
Yes, I'm saying I bet Trey Jones is like, you know, 6'1.5" or 6'2" best. You know what I mean? Like he's somewhere in that range. 190 pounds. He turned 20 in January. He'll turn 21. So he'll turn 21 next January. But he's young, pretty young for a sophomore. Already has over 2,300, you know, close to 2,300 minutes in college under his belt. 1,300 of those coming in the ACC. Some intangibles, just a winner. 53-12 during his college career, plus an ACC title, just a quiet leader. His teammates would run through a wall for this guy. And I think that matters. Coaches loved coaching him. As much as Krzyzewski enjoyed coaching Zion in RJ last season, I think Trey was like his favorite player of the last two seasons, just adored Trey. And he sort of is every coach's dream because he's a smart point guard and he's an absolute dog defensively. And I just think he has this like underrated skill at being like kind of good at everything. I think potentially his on-ball defense is elite, but he's a little smaller, but he just, there's no real, like he made enough of a jump this season that I don't think there's sort of like a glaring weakness in his game. He's kind of good at everything. But all right, we'll just go into his defense here on the basketball. Just an absolute pest, you know, one of the best in college hoops the last couple of years. And he absolutely wrecked a bunch of really good guards while he was at Duke. He just obliterated Kobe White on a couple possessions 2 seasons ago, eviscerated Shamori Ponds when they played St. John's last season. I mean, literally St. John's took the ball out of Ponds' hands during that game. And that's not the only time Trey Jones did that, by, you know, picking up full court and just completely taking a team out of its offense. It happened against Clemson last season, happened against Syracuse last season too. And he pushed Cole Anthony into some bad decisions this year as well, but just gets in a stance, exceptional side to side speed and balance, fluid movements, quick, smooth hips. He actually kind of reminds me of, Richie, you watch tennis, don't you?
Yeah, a little bit.
Yeah. Do you know, like he reminds me, his lateral moves remind me of Novak Djokovic a little bit, actually. He's just like, he's like a cat or a slinky. He's just so quick and spry side to side. He can just chop real quickly, get in a stance and just man, back arch. He's like Chris Paul defensively. Like, those guys get in a stance. It's the fundamentals are so sound with Trey Jones. He's not blessed with like incredible wingspan or length. I mean, he has quick hands. I think I'm guessing his wingspan comes out as plus, but it's probably nothing too crazy. But you know, if you go to a basketball camp, or Spencer, you were a high school coach, when you were coaching your players to defend and guard one-on-one, where did you tell them to put their eyes defensively when they're guarding someone one-on-one?
Waist.
Right into their chest.
Yep. I'm telling you, I saw Trey up close a lot in college. I've never seen another player that had more like eye focus on his opponent's, his abdomen area, waist, chest, just locked in, but having like good peripheral vision too, seeing screens, having good vision behind him as a defender. He's a good pick and roll defender. You can see he anticipates screens. He's able to get around them and navigate them while also staying active and bothering the ball handler. Like, I think he's going to be really good defensively in the NBA. Excellent, in my opinion, as a ball screen defender, recovers quickly. Like I said, uses a lot of that same fundamentals are sound, and uses that lateral quickness and those quick hands to bother and be a pest even against screens. Team defense, solid again. Spot on with his assignments. Gambles a little bit, but not too much. Excellent tracking the basketball in the air. Definitely will take the occasional calculated risk, but he's able to still recover because, again, he's so quick. And he just has this ability to keep guys in front of him with his ability to slide and to move and to cut off space and angles. And with those quick hands, I mean, his steals numbers were monstrous at Duke, a career steal rate of 3% for his career, 2.1 steals per 40 minutes, too. And I'll let you guys jump in here too, but like, I think you could maybe question some of his versatility defensively because he is smaller.
Yeah.
But I do think because he's so physical and because he's so darn good at moving his feet, he plays with this low center of gravity, which allows him to dig in. And he did all right when he, like, especially his freshman year when he had to switch and guard post-ups because Duke switched so much during that 18-19 season. You factor in all of those things, and I think he can guard, you know, 2-3 positions, assuming, you know, these guys are lower usage. He's going to struggle against bigger, high usage wings, no doubt. But I think he can give you 2-3 positions defensively, and I think he can give you elite point guard defense as well at the point of attack too.
Yeah, I mean, look, Trey Jones is you can't not like him. I mean, he's the ultimate competitor. And that's what's going to get him likely drafted in the first round. You would think he's older than he is. He'll be probably around a little more than 20 and a half years old when he's drafted. I mean, his intangibles, Brian mentioned all this. They're incredible. I will say that he should not have been the ACC player of the year. I will say that.
I agree. I agree on that.
That should have been his
Vernon Carey,
his teammate. Yeah. But that's okay. His mentality and the work he probably put in throughout the season made him deserving of that award. But the numbers don't tell the same story, but that's okay. I don't see a very high ceiling for Trey Jones. He's not the greatest athlete in the world. He does have quick hands. No, he's not twitchy, but he's always in the right place. He takes smart gambles. The guy has a high steal rate, not because he shoots every single passing lane, because he's got quick hands and he knows when to gamble. Because Brian, it's a great point you made, you know, staring at the center of somebody's body, either their chest or, Richie, you said waist. Waist is fine too. Stare at the center of somebody, stare at their spine. Their spine is going to tell you where the ball is going. And that's what he got so good at. He's just got incredible IQ and instincts for the game. I think his one swing skill is shooting.
Yeah.
If he can learn to shoot the ball, let's see, he shot.
He made a jump this year shooting the basketball.
Yeah, I mean, too. Yeah, 36% from behind the arc this year. You know, that's, is that right, Brian? 36%?
Yeah, 36%. Yeah.
Okay, that's higher than I thought it was. So that's good for him. I mean, let's just put it this way. If Trey Jones could shoot 40%, you know, on catch and shoots, not coming off the dribble, 40% on catch and shoots in the NBA, I think he'd be starting point guard potentially, who could play off the ball with another swing skill or combo guard.
Yeah.
Otherwise, he's going to be a backup point guard and a very good backup point guard, but I just think that's the ceiling. So if you're going to take
like his brother.
Yeah, very much like his brother. So, you know, if you're going to take him in the first round, then it's just it's pretty simple, right? It's the team towards the end of the first round that needs a backup point guard. Portland comes to mind for me. Mm-hmm. They won't necessarily be to the back of the first round, but, you know, that's just a team that came to my mind. Other than that, to be honest with you, I think he's a second round talent. But because of all of his intangibles that other guys don't bring to the table and his understanding of the game and his competitive spirit and his high IQ, he should be drafted in the first round for all those reasons.
Yeah, I mean, of these three players, he's probably the most unexciting, but he's also probably the one that I feel most comfortable drafting just because he has that high floor. You know what you're going to get with Trey Jones. And Brian was right. There's nothing that really like stands out as a strength, but there's nothing really that stands out as a weakness as well. He's just kind of a middle of the road guy. You know that when you draft this guy that you could probably project him to be a good backup point guard. And sure, he could rise and sure, he could fall off. He's a high IQ guy that, you know, he still needs to improve that shot, like you said, Spencer, and improve that finishing at the rim. But, you know, just being a floor general, good passer on the move, good floor leader. He can pass out of the pick and roll. He has a really good lob pass. I mean, obviously working with Zion helps that a lot, but he can pass the ball.
Stanley too.
Yeah, so lead ahead pass as well. And like Brian was mentioned, he's a very pesky defender, gets his hands in the passing lanes. I may be a little bit lower on like his switchability. I think that he's very good at guarding his position, but maybe that's kind of all I view him as right now. Mostly because of his size and him just not being that type of athlete. But again, like I said, you guys mentioned a lot of this, but I just feel most comfortable drafting him out of the three players that we mentioned. But he also doesn't excite me either.
Just quick, like putting a quick eye on the end of the first round here, you know, could really use him as New York at 27 with that pick they got from LA. Like that,
reunite him and RJ.
New York needs that kind. They need that kind of player. They need that kind of guy who gets it in the locker room, and they need help at point guard.
Yeah. A couple other things I'll throw out about Trey. I think his transition offense, I think he actually stands out as a transition player, an elite transition passer, similar to, we talked about this with Tyrese Halliburton, a month ago or so, but just elite vision, elite timing, elite touch on these passes, the ability to throw guys open into space, either off these just crazy, you know, whip bounce passes or these, you know, line drive sort of, but like lofted passes over the top. I think, again, to dip into another sport, if you think about soccer for a second, he reminds me of like a defensive midfielder that has the ability to create a vent, to get a steal or to dispossess the ball from his opponent, and then to immediately turn it into efficient offense by, boom, I got the ball. All right, I'm forcing tempo up the court. Halliburton sort of does that too. So there's some Yaya Toure or some, you know, a Pirlo or a Steven Gerrard, if you will. I did talk to a soccer buddy of mine to get some of these, to shore up some of these names, but he's got, that's what I think of him as, like a defensive midfielder that can immediately ignite transition offense. And so I just think it's like, as soon as he gets a steal, the value of that possession, like the expected value, if you could do the math for that, I think it's high, because he's going to make low mistake player, low turnover player, but yet he's able to force tempo and force transition. Smart ball handler in transition as well, too. Understands angle, the timing of teammates when they're running. Just beautiful touch, Richie, as you said, on those lob passes. Last couple of years, he threw some of the craziest lobs we saw in college hoops to Stanley and to Zion. And he has this ability, too, in transition where it's almost like he's snaking a ball screen in pick and roll, but he's doing it without a screen in transition, where he'll drive like against the grain, like diagonally. Uh-huh. And he'll bring a defender with him, or he'll cut into the back of another defender, and then he'll slip it back behind the play for a layup or a dunk. Just a smart player. And then I'll throw this out here as well, too. Just good shooting runners and floaters, was one of the ACC's best shooting around the elbows this season. So that's a lot of him coming off those ball screens. Duke ran a lot of horns with VCJ and Matthew Hurt. But his freshman season, Trey Jones, 26% shooting on threes, 49% true shooting, 3.3 three-point attempts per 40 minutes, and only 7% of his threes were unassisted. So let's go to his sophomore season, 36% shooting on threes, up 10%. True shooting, 52%, up 3%, taking 4.2 three-point attempts per 40 minutes, so almost one more attempt per 40 minutes there too. And 41% of his threes were unassisted. He's got a bit of a line drive shot, but he looked for a pull-up three in transition, a fair like semi-transition, secondary break stuff a lot this season. Last year as a freshman, Trey Jones, 43% effective shooting on spot-up, no dribble jumpers this season, up to 66%. Effective shooting on spot up jumpers for Trey Jones this season as well. One last indicator, 77% shooting from the free throw line in his career, over 200 free throw attempts too. And yeah, his pick and roll usage went way up this year and as well too. Efficiency, modest improvement, but the usage way, way, way higher in terms of the volume of pick and roll possessions that he used.
Well, speaking of line drive shots and your free throw percentage, he's really good at missing free throws on purpose, especially against UNC.
He put his use to historically important use, actually. He did.
All right, let's let's wrap this episode. If you guys have not watched the first four episodes of The Last Dance on ESPN about the 1997-98 Bulls team, this would be the time to kind of tune out. There's some spoilers, I guess, if you want to call it. I mean, obviously the season has already occurred, but we're going to be talking about the documentary and how we're enjoying this, because as of now, as sports fans, there's no live sports. We get excited about the NFL draft, and we're going to get excited about The Last Dance. So let's just give our kind of quick thoughts on this documentary so far. It's a 10-part series, and they air two episodes per week. I'll actually say this, I don't actually stay up and watch them live. I watch them the next morning or afternoon, and my viewing experience is sometimes tricky because Beckett is always by my side and I have to entertain him, but I try to watch it as best as I can. I forgot all the drama that was heading into the season with Jerry Krause, and they do a good job of kind of setting that up in episode one. And you know, obviously Scottie Pippen, his issues too, in terms of delaying his surgery and how Michael Jordan wasn't too happy about that. It's crazy to think that this team won the championship heading into the season, knowing that it's going to be Phil Jackson's last season, knowing that MJ is probably going to be leaving too because he's tied to Phil Jackson, knowing that Scottie Pippen is not happy. It's kind of crazy that they overcame those things. Clearly they had talent and they focus on each of the players. They've done a good job of focusing on MJ and Scottie and Dennis Rodman. In one of the more recent episodes, he was funny to listen to, and his little hiatus down in Vegas was just crazy. I don't think that would happen in today's game, but I'm enjoying it. I don't know if it's lived up to the hype, but clearly people are tuning in. But I'm really enjoying it. What are your thoughts so far on The Last Dance, Spencer?
Yeah, I've enjoyed it too. Probably more so than I would if there are a lot of other things going on. But no, I think it was good. You know, the Jerry Krause stuff earlier was certainly baffling. Like, how could you even consider breaking up a team that had been that successful, you know, up to that point? Certainly a lot of ego involved with him, but yeah, I mean, you know, episodes 3 and 4, I think definitely started to open up more of Jordan and what he had to demand of certain players. I'm actually more fascinated with the Scottie Pippen narrative, I think, than like the Dennis Rodman. I mean, obviously Dennis Rodman is unlike very few people on planet Earth. So he is, you know, his narrative's interesting. He comes from an awful background, and how he made it and with the attitude he made it with is like kind of wild to even figure out how that happened. But Scottie Pippen and the type of personality he is, combined with his talent, you know, combined with what he had to deal with Jordan, and then what he had to deal with in terms of how much Chicago appreciated him, which is not nearly enough as they should have, having to deal with them not renegotiating his contract when they clearly should have done that. Like, to stick through all that, I actually think he went above and beyond anybody not named Michael Jordan on that team, because he had every reason to say this just isn't fair. Mm-hmm. And he did do that. He did do that, right? Like, he was away from the team. He didn't get surgery in the summer when he should have, or depending on what you believe, when he could have, and he got it on the team's time and rehabbed on the team's dime and their time. So to me, the Pippen narrative in all this is 100% the most interesting.
Yeah, that's interesting. I didn't think of it that way. Obviously, I kind of am more interested in the MJ aspect, but yeah, the Scottie Pippen aspect is interesting as well. It's also interesting to notice like some of the ex-teammates like he played against, like Dennis Rodman against Detroit. He played against Ron Harper in 1989 against Cleveland. But my favorite clip of the show, and I'm going to go ahead and play it. Brian, maybe you can break this down. Can you understand what Dennis Rodman is talking about here when he's talking about the rebound?
I just practiced a lot about the angle of the ball and the trajectory of it. You got a Larry Bird, it's going to spin. You got a Magic, and maybe spin. When Michael shoot over here, I position myself right there. Now I hit the rim, it's boom, click and go back this way, boom, here, here, click and go that way, boom, that way, click here and go like this way. So basically, I just start learning how to put myself in a position to get the ball.
That was Dennis Rodman explaining how he went into gyms and had people miss shots on purpose and how he practiced rebounding. I mean, that guy is just, the way that he explained it too was just, I was just sitting there watching the TV. I was like, what are you talking about?
I love the thought of him going into a gym with like Michael Carter Williams and just telling MCW to just try to make the shots. And I'm going to practice my offensive rebounding here. No, I think what he's doing in so many words there, if I can translate worm here for a second, is he's explaining, you know, Larry Bird putting a lot of backspin on his shot, Magic Johnson not doing quite as much of that. And then he's also just explaining, like, this is what weak side rebounding is on offense, right? You know what I mean? Like when MJ shoots, I need to be on the opposite side of the court to try to look for a long rebound. I'm guessing that's what he's doing. But obviously, Dennis has his own sort of his own terminology inside of the English language that that makes it that makes for a little bit more character with his response. Yeah, I mean, I'll be honest with you. I thought the first two episodes were good. I definitely enjoyed it, but I thought they were like, okay. I thought episodes 3 and 4 were pretty awesome, and I really enjoyed them. I agree with Spencer. I thought the Pippen stuff was fascinating. The Rodman stuff is interesting. The Phil Jackson stuff. I mean, I'm excited to hear more about Kukoc and some of these other guys that were coming along the way. It's just interesting to hear the – we all know the MJ story, but you just know less about these other guys. And it's fascinating to hear about the role players that were, you know, sort of around for the ride or were obviously played huge roles on it too. I think it's a little fascinating. People have talked about this before already, but like it is crazy that the Bulls, A, they had these two just transformative athletes. To have like Jordan and Pippen in the 80s, in the early 90s, it's like, I mean, what an advantage. You know, I mean, just two athletes that I think were outlier at the time, you know? And to have two of those guys on the same team is nuts. And to see how they built a roster around that with, you know, especially after Bill Cartwright, no high usage centers and playing the game dominant through two wings and being able to go small with Kukoc and Rodman and Ron Harper as another wing and guard. That stuff's fascinating. And I even thought the stuff from this past week's episode on the triangle offense, like that was cool. And there was one shot they put in the documentary. It was like an above overhead shot looking down on the Bulls, like working in their half court offense. And it was showing both sides of the court going through various reads of the triangle. So, you know, handoff, a cut, a pass, so swinging the ball to the other side of the court. And the graphic that the documentary used had this like triangle sort of like moving in real time with them. I thought it was just like a beautiful shot. And hell, I'm no like huge fan of the triangle offense, but if I could have like an image of that framed, I would hang it in my office. I thought it looked awesome, you know? So anyways, it's been really cool. It's been interesting. You know, it's been sort of zeitgeisty. There is this like live sports aspect of it where everyone's watching it. That's interesting. So I look forward to Sunday nights now. That's the, you know, now that Better Call Saul is over with, Mondays are irrelevant and Sunday is the only day of the week for me now. So I do look forward to The Last Dance Sunday night. And, you know, we've got 6 more hours of it left. So that's pretty exciting too.
Yeah, the last thought I wanted to sneak in here, you know, Phil Jackson, I've really enjoyed learning more about him and how he got started with Chicago. And I didn't know that guy coached in Puerto Rico.
I didn't either. I knew the CBA stuff. I didn't know Puerto Rico though.
Yeah. I knew he was a fascinating guy who has, you know, some life philosophy styles that he believes in that definitely bleed over into his, how he managed the Bulls and then how he would manage the Lakers later. His emotional intelligence shows up in the documentary so quickly. And what I think is really cool is the link between him and Steve Kerr, because you can tell how many things Steve Kerr learned from Phil Jackson. I mean, it's I would say that if there were like the top 10 traits, coaching traits Steve Kerr has, nine of them come from Phil Jackson, maybe 10 of them. And I don't agree with everything Steve Kerr says, you know, but he is an incredibly smart coach that knows how to connect with the most egotistical, talented guys in the National Basketball Association, and Phil could do the exact same thing.
He benefits from, I mean, it's crazy. He got to play for Phil Jackson and then Greg Popovich. I mean, that's pretty incredible. But I sort of enjoy it for Phil too, because I think the end of his tenure where he was working in operations for New York, you know, it sort of ended unceremoniously. He wasn't really up for the job. He wasn't particularly good at it. I think at times he sort of came across as like old and doddering. And so it's cool for to have this, to look back and to see young Phil and middle-aged Phil as like, you know, basketball savant, this genius coach that was willing to get input from others, including his star players and his assistant coaches and stuff too. So it's not like a redemption. It's not like a redemption arc or anything like that, but it's just a reminder. It's like, the job between being a coach and an executive is different. And once upon a time, this guy was very well thought of as a basketball mind across different eras too, you know?
Throw the New York stuff out, I mean, to me. But, you know, for him to take, I think the ultimate measuring point for me in Chicago, I mean, he had a lot after Chicago, but to take the gamble, and he had to be even Phil had to be talked into it, as open-minded as he is, he had to be talked into and convinced. Now we're going to take, we need Dennis Rodman. We need what he brings to the table to get over Detroit. And he was like, okay, all right, bring in Dennis Rodman. And he found a way to meet that guy where he was. And that, look, Dennis brought so much good to that team, but he's as challenging of a player I can imagine to coach as they've ever been made, right? I don't know. I think that's the coolest part about Phil Jackson's coaching job, is saying, okay, let's go, bring him in. This is what we need, and it worked.
One of the last things I'll throw in is specific to MJ. He is like a fascinating personality on this, because it's interesting to see both Michael in the 90s and Michael now in 2019 or 2020, you know, whenever they filmed these parts with him, you know, what bothers him versus what doesn't bother him. You know what I mean? Like he's mad at Scottie Pippen for having a migraine, or like confused with Pippen having a migraine. But if Dennis wants to go to Vegas, like, all right, like let's roll the dice and see what happens. You know, like even that's sort of interesting. He's got, because he was such an incredible player and such a, just a, you know, a outlier competitor, outlier athlete, outlier champion, just a historically dominant force. It reminded me of, you know, during Hornets games when he sits at the end of the bench, do you know what I'm talking about? A couple times a year this happens and you're just like, he sits there and his energy just hangs over everything.
It's just locked in.
Yeah, you know, yeah. And
he does it on purpose for the players. Yeah. And the other half is he just can't help
it. Yep, 100%. And so that, it's been, seeing this documentary has been reminding me of those moments that I've seen, you know, sporadically the last couple of seasons of Hornets basketball too.
It's a good point, Brian. He definitely seems skeptical of like Scottie Pippen's migraine. Like, I don't know what it was, but he's like, I guess that was the migraine game for Scottie Pippen. But like, he didn't seem like he was fully convinced about that.
He'll only concede to a certain very thin extent with Scottie. He'll tell you that's my best teammate ever. But Scottie was the closest that ever sniffed to Jordan in Jordan's prime. And so Jordan's only going to give him so much slack. He would never let Scottie go to Vegas for 48 hours. He'll let Dennis go. So,
yeah. All right, guys. Thanks again for tuning in to another Buzz Beat. If you want to support this podcast, please go ahead and give us a rating and review on Apple Podcast. And we will see you guys next time.